For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, if you were here last week, we kind of ended in the middle of a story that started in chapter 13 of Acts, where Paul and Barnabas had been sent out by God to plant churches in these different cities. And they came to this city called Iconium. Paul and Barnabas went, as usual, to the Jewish synagogue. There they spoke so effectively that a great number of Jews and Gentiles believed. But the Jews who refused to believe stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. Okay, well, so here's where we left it last week. So he's gone down now to the next city, Iconium, from Antioch of Pisidian and Antioch. And then from there, he's going to go to the city of Lystra and then to the city of Derbe. After that, he's going to turn around and go back up through the same cities that he came down and sail back home to Antioch. That's the first journey. So we're on these last three cities, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe are the ones we're reading about tonight. So after that, Paul and Barnabas spent considerable time there speaking boldly for the Lord, who confirmed the message of his grace by enabling them to do miraculous signs and wonders. And so all of that prayer that was going on back in Antioch still mattered, and you can see God working here. People of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews, others with the apostles. There was a plot afoot among the Gentiles and Jews together with their leaders to mistreat and stone them. But they found out about it and fled to the Lycaonian cities of Lystra and Derbe, to the surrounding country, where they continued to preach the good news. In Lystra, there sat a man crippled in his feet. He was lame from birth. He had never walked. He listened to Paul as he was speaking. Paul looked directly at him and he saw that he had faith to be healed. Isn't that an interesting thing? Somehow Paul looked at this guy and knew in advance that he was going to be able to heal him. I guess that's what it's like when you have the gift of healing. I don't have it. Somehow he knew that this was going to happen. He called out, "Stand up on your feet." And at that, the man jumped up and began to walk. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lycaonian language, "The gods have come down to us in human form." Not an unusual feeling in a lot of ancient culture. You read Greek literature, they often, if somebody did something remarkable, they would interpret it that they're divine, that it was a god in human form. Barnabas, they began to call Zeus, and Paul, they called Hermes because he was the chief speaker. Hermes is the messenger of the gods. So that would be Paul because he's the talker. I don't know why Barnabas gets to be Zeus. Anyway, the priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought bulls and wreaths to the city gates because he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifices to them. They really think that they're gods. You know, I mean, that kind of thing was possible in Greek mythology, that a god would visit you like that. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of this, they tore their clothes and rushed into the crowd, shouting, "Man, why are you doing this? We too are only men, human, like you. We're bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven and earth, sea and everything in them." Okay, and so this, we've come to give you good news. We are not gods, okay? We're men like you. We're bringing you good news. That is this term, euangelion, good news. A good message, and which is translated a lot of times the gospel. That's the word for gospel. Good news. And telling you to turn from these worthless things. What is that referring to? Worthless things. In the context, it's referring to their religion, their worship of Zeus. And, you know, they're getting ready to offer sacrifices with bulls. And Paul, not too PC here, says, You know, those are worthless things. You should forget about that. Can you believe that he's speaking about other people's sincerely held religious beliefs in that way? What's wrong with him? Pretty arrogant, sounds like. And all they wanted, you know. Well, of course, it's interesting when you read an ancient account like this, because the Greeks believed that Zeus caused lightning and rain to happen. They think he was the god of the storm. And so he would hurl javelins, which was the lightning, were the javelins of Zeus that were being thrown. Now these days, not too many still believe that. In fact, hardly anyone still thinks when we see lightning that this is Zeus hurling his spear. We know, in fact, that lightning is caused by something other than a god doing that. And so you don't find very many Zeus worshipers around anymore. This entire religious cult has completely disappeared. What about that? It seems like, yes, these were probably, for some at least, sincerely held beliefs. And yet, Paul's point, sincerely false, actually completely mistaken. There's no such thing as Zeus. Now, we would say there's no such thing as Zeus today, but you know, there was no such thing then either, even though people believed in it. It's not the passage of time that has changed anything here. What we're dealing with is the question of truth in the objective sense as opposed to the subjective sense. Like you could say, well, that's really true for me too. Like that's a subjective truth because it's like I experienced the reality of that. But we're talking about, what about objective truth? Is truth that's out there, truth that I don't, that isn't true because I believe it. It's just true. You know, like the moon exists. And whether that's not because we want it to exist or we believe it exists, it's actually exists. That's objective. It's objective, not dependent on the subjective knower or perceiver. It's there, all right. Well, there's other objective truths too, including in the spiritual area. The existence or non-existence of God, of an infinite personal God, is an objective truth question. It's not just a question of what you decide to believe. Yes, that's another question, but the important question here is what's actually true. Well, Paul speaks to these people, and it's interesting because in the last speech we saw of his, he was speaking to people in the synagogue, people who already had kind of a biblical worldview, Jewish, you know, Old Testament believers. Now he's speaking to polytheistic pagans who have nothing to do with the Bible, have no idea about anything biblical. And so it's interesting to contrast how he speaks to these people compared to how he spoke to the other people. We notice that he already says that we're telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made heaven and earth and sea and everything in them. The creator, the living God, a term from the Old Testament. It's like the God who is actually there. Like you could carve, they did carve idols to Zeus, pictures, representations of Zeus but it was just an inanimate, you know, idol. And he says, that's not alive. The living God, the God who actually creates, that's the God I've come to talk to you about. And so, yeah, who made the heaven and earth and sea and everything in them. And so he refers to the act of creation as an inroad. He says throughout history, he has let all the nations go their own way. That's one of the clearest statements in the New Testament about something known as free will. You know, people say, well, if God is, if there's an infinite personal God, how can we have a world that is evil? How can we have wrongdoing in the world like we see and suffering and all that kind of thing if God's so powerful and he's so loving? Well, there's your answer. You let the nations go their own way. The biblical doctrine of the fall, that humanity has turned away from God and that he has taken a pretty hands-off posture you know, regarding the world. He lets people do what they want most of the time. And it's important because, you know, if it weren't for this doctrine of free will, where would we be left? Everything that happens on earth would be the result and the causality of God. He would be the author not only of good, but of evil. But once we create this concept, the space here for something like free will, that's a different picture. And we will find then whoever makes free decisions is also responsible for those decisions. So if people are freely deciding to turn away from God, then they and they alone are responsible for that decision and everything that comes out of it. When we turn away from God, we forfeit not only his presence and his love, but also his protection. And so the entire world, ecology and everything is out of control. And things happen that destroy people because God's not going to protect us. And yet, he says, he has not left himself without a testimony. He's shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. It's interesting. So creation and then this testimony, he says, this says something about God. And he's referring to the processes of nature, has a statement to make about God. Now, remember, this whole sermon that we're reading here is only, what, 4 or 5 verses, so it reads in 15 seconds or less. I'm sure it's a summary. This is, again, we have to read between the lines to kind of sense what it is that he's referring to here. I'm sure he spoke longer than 15 seconds. We know, too, how we have information on how Paul views these questions because of the stuff he wrote in his other books. This is probably referring to something called external general revelation. Now, special revelation is revelation like in the Bible, where God has actually spoken and given us detailed information about himself. General revelation is revelation that you can infer from what we look out and see in the world out here. You look out your window and see a natural world there, and there's something about that world that tells you God exists. And not only that he exists, but also what sort of God he must be. We can read Paul's explanation for this in Romans 1:20, where he says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made." So they're without excuse. Okay, so he points to what has been made. That is, through creation. He says, you look at creation and you can see these different aspects of God disclosed, revealed in a general way through creation. Well, let's think about this a little bit. This is really an argument from design. This is called an argument from design. If you want to be fancy, you can call it a teleological argument, okay? I don't recommend that. Design's good enough. The argument from design is pretty simple. It says the presence of design implies the presence of a designer. Okay? Let's take this picture right here. This is a bottle, and you can't see it too well, but inside of the bottle is a disassembled watch. The kind, not a digital one, but the kind with the wheels and the pointer. Analog watch, I guess, is what they're called. So I took it, you know, got the little screwdriver and took the whole thing. There's probably a couple of dozen parts to this watch in that bottle. Now suppose I start to shake the bottle, and so the parts are kind of dancing around and coming into collision with different parts. Perhaps, you know, if you did this long enough, then one of the screws would line up with the holes, and it would. And the wheel would be screwed on where it, you know, and then from there, maybe eventually, you know, it might take a long time, maybe another one of the wheels that would be fit in the spring, and this watch could reassemble itself. Because after all the pieces are there, all the needed pieces are there, and the energy is also there because they're bouncing around and there are collisions happening. So who's to say, but what it might be possible that eventually this watch would assemble itself back together again. See, I think we all know the answer to that question. Even if we shook it fairly hard, shook it fast, even if, in fact, we had a million of these bottles and shook them all like this, each one with its own watch inside of it, a number of things could be predicted, but one thing for certain is that that watch will never reassemble itself. That is not going to happen, and we all know that's true. If we do this for a billion years, we'll have a pile of dust in there, but we will certainly not have a watch. The reason being, yes, the pieces are all there. Yes, the sufficient energy is there. But what is going to connect the energy to the work of assembling the watch according to a specific pattern that has to be followed in order for the watch to work? That requires information, which is not in this model. This model just has randomness, energy, and matter, but the information necessary to assemble a watch, which is not rocket science. I mean, it's not like that's super advanced, but there would be probably 20 to 50 steps that you had to go through to assemble this watch. And since that information is not contained in this model, we'll never get a watch. Well, I think that's most people can see that. And this is even far, far more true when it comes to our work. You can recognize design when you see it. That's what this clip is about. Let's play that. What do you suppose that is?
Well, it's hollow. But maybe it floats.
From something scientific or a baby toy.
It's kind of shaped like a bike seat.
Excellent. And could that be like maybe a Star Trek badge?
I have no clue.
That's right.
Yeah, it must be some fixture.
I have absolutely no idea.
I don't know, honestly.
You broke it. Well, where do you suppose I could find something like that? I mean, does that sort of thing grow on a tree? I mean, do I find it in the ground?
I would say go over to the engineering building.
I'd say the internet, because you can get just about anything there.
In a store or someplace like that.
At a pharmacy.
Craft store, maybe?
So why do you think it has a purpose?
It looks like it serves some sort of thing. It's got two pieces. It's got these little grooves, which looks like something has or could fit in.
My rationalist indoctrination by Western civilization.
Just kind of the connectable parts, man.
I'm sure it has some purpose. I don't think people would make it otherwise.
Everything has a purpose.
It's molded into a shape. One piece fits into the other.
So it shows the evidence of a design of some sort.
Evidence that's been designed and made by human beings, yes.
You're going to look at this thing and say, well, this is a man-made object, or this is designed. How do you know?
I don't know.
It's not naturally growing from the earth.
Because it had to be designed by someone and created.
It has to have been made by somebody.
Been created. Somebody had to make it. It just doesn't make itself on its own.
Do you think somebody made this thing?
Yeah, I think they made it for a certain purpose, I guess.
What evidence of design or manufacturing do you see?
Symmetry.
Excellent. Symmetry. What's that mean?
It means it's equal on both sides.
The geometry of some of the holes and the dividing line down the center.
And it's in a specific form and shape, and it fits together. I don't think it's natural.
It seems pretty standardized. I mean, it doesn't look too choppy. It seems pretty smooth, pretty man-made. Design of it, possibly.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously placed together in some type of way, so it was human-made.
It's molded, it's shaped, it's perfectly shaped. Nothing naturally made would be this perfect.
Well, they could all tell that thing was man-made. It wasn't too. Some of them didn't really know why they thought it. You know, it's like that's not a real complex proposition. It's like a couple of the people we talked to there, I would say, were not extremely smart people. The jock guy. But they all knew the answer. All of them felt certain that they knew the answer, even if they didn't know why. It's just obvious. It's really obvious. Well, I want to take this then and consider this proposition that our world manifests the presence of design, just like that object, and even way, way beyond that object, in fact. Let's take up the question tonight of inorganic evolution. Okay, this is evolution, not from one organism to another, but rather from non-living matter molecules into the first living organism. This is an area I've thought about a lot, and I find it very persuasive. I don't think this could have happened by accident. I would say that it would be far more likely that that watch would put itself together, or that that blue thing was not man-made. I would say either of them would be way more likely than what we're being asked to believe when it comes to the idea of just molecules assembling themselves in a way that comes to life. Now, here's why. We have to remember that every single protein molecule, even the smallest one, in the smallest known living thing, contains at least 400 amino acid lengths, typically containing more than 7 million atoms. A protein is a very complex molecule, okay? And that's what living organisms are all made out of, proteins. Each cell has to have millions, even the simplest cell has to have millions of protein molecules of specific types that are arranged in specific ways in order for the organism to live. For an organism to be alive, it has to be capable of self-propagation, right? Having kids, dividing in half. Some way it has to be able to propagate itself. It has to be able to take in matter, food of some sort, and metabolize that food through digestion and through very complicated chemical reactions, form it into new protein that can replicate the cell. There's other functions they have to be able to do as well, ridding themselves of waste and so forth, but let's just think about, let's keep it simple here. Feeding, metabolizing, and replicating yourself would be a minimum requirement, because even if something was alive but it couldn't replicate, it would die eventually, and then you'd be right back to where you started. Well, this is very complicated business. I don't know how many of you have really studied cell biology much. You're supposed to study it if you're in arts and sciences. You're supposed to take Bio 101 and 102 or whatever, and inside of each and every living cell, the complexity is incredible. Every cell has dozens of these little organelles, which is like an organ in your body, but an organelle is on an extremely small microscopic level. And these organelles work together to carry out these functions that are absolutely necessary in order for life to occur and for digestion to occur, for replication to occur. You know, the endoplasmic reticulum is where protein molecules are fabricated according to an instruction set given. And the Golgi apparatus sorts them out and folds them and carries them out to the place in the cell where that particular protein is needed. Mitochondrion is where the Krebs cycle occurs. That's where fats or sugars can be metabolized into energy for the cell. And Then, of course, there's the nucleus with it, with DNA, extremely complex protein that has to be read by RNA and tRNA and carried out. And by section, that's what gives the instructions for what protein to produce. It's an astonishingly complicated process that makes the watch look like a block of wood. I mean, this is millions of times more complex than that. The guy talking in this movie is Professor Dean Kenyon, who is one of the a recognized world authority in microbiology. This guy wrote an authoritative textbook called Biochemical Evolution, was the name of the textbook, which for a couple of decades was a standard text in grad schools, studying microbiology. And his whole theory that he was working with his associate was maybe there are properties in these compounds, amino acids, which can occur naturally, which cause them to link up in the ways necessary to produce protein, and that this might have just happened like as an accident because of the way the attractional forces work between the particular molecules there. And what happened is that as he studied this further, he came to doubt his own theory and eventually realized that was not possible. Here's what he says about it.
It's an enormous problem how you could get together in one tiny submicroscopic volume of the primitive ocean all of the hundreds of different molecular components you would need in order for a self-replicating cycle to be established. And so my doubts about whether amino acids could order themselves into meaningful biological sequences on their own without pre-existing genetic material being present just reached, I guess for me, the intellectual breaking point sometime near the end of the decade of the 70s.
As Kenyon reevaluated his theory, new biochemical discoveries further weakened his conviction that amino acids could have organized themselves into proteins.
The more I conducted my own studies, including a period of time at NASA Ames Research Center, the more it became apparent that there were multiple difficulties with the chemical evolution account. And further experimental work showed that amino acids do not have the ability to order themselves into any biologically meaningful sequences. The more I thought about the alternative that was being presented in the criticism and the enormous problem that all of us who worked on this field had neglected to address, the problem of the origin of genetic information itself, then I really had to reassess my whole position regarding origins.
With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that's, that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of an immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the Earth.
Now, let me make a couple of points here before we don't want to, you know, these structures that they're referring to, you know, that very orderly, that nuclear port that he was talking about only lets certain compounds through. It won't let others through. That's got to be designed. Good Lord, how could that happen by accident? Many of these structures are very orderly, the way they line up and appear. And the like here with the mitochondria, this is where extremely complicated chemical reactions are carried out that can produce energy for the cell. There's that perinuclear Golgi complex. You know, there's the ribosomes going into the endoplasmic reticulum and forming that new protein molecule. Here's a crucial point to remember. This is crucial. All of these processes have to be present in every living cell. So to have some of them present would equal nothing, okay? They would have to all be present. To get life, you would have to have all of these things present at once, at one time. All of these processes would have to somehow come together, come into existence. People say, well, you know, evolution can really accomplish a lot. Do. No, not on this, okay? Yeah, evolution, natural selection, that's fine. I think that, I hate it when Christians say, well, there's no such thing as evolution. You're wrong on that, okay? Natural selection has been demonstrated. That is a process that is real, but it doesn't apply to this situation. Natural selection only applies when you have replication already going on for a gene to mutate and form a different organism that may be more survivable. That only happens after you have replication going on. Simply having non-living molecules bouncing around has nothing to do with natural selection. I hope you can understand that. I mean, that's just the way it is. Natural selection, evolution is a theory that has strictly to do with already living organisms. That has nothing to do with non-living molecules and organic matter. when we look at that clip we just watched and see the intricacy of the process needed to produce these very specific molecules that have to be made exactly the right way, and you're going to tell me that that might have just happened? No. This is not an accident. Somebody made that happen. Somebody really smart put that system together. And I for one will never believe, I cannot believe that something like that could ever happen as a matter of accidental molecular collisions. And that's what Kenyon was saying. He just says it reached the intellectual breaking point for him. Now, I hope you understand. I hope you realize that there is a reason why people would prefer to believe that there is not a creator God. I hope we're not too naive to realize that here tonight. Once we admit the presence of an infinite personal God, the implications just cascade right out of it. And they take us in directions that we may not want to go.
I know what I'm talking about. I've been right there. You'd get these, when I was atheistic, there would be certain times when I would start to doubt and think, what if God's actually there after all? And you'd be like, no, you didn't want to think about that because your radar told you where that was headed. Next thing you know, someone's going to be telling me what to do. My autonomy is going to be compromised if I admit that. Oh yeah, there's plenty of good reasons to not want to believe this. What are the chances of this happening by accident? There is no chance of that. There's no chance at all. Really, none. The watch? You think the watch? That watch is so primitive compared to what we're looking at here. If you think the watch is not going to assemble itself, how could you ever think that cell would? Evolution certainly has nothing to do with it. And so we conclude our world does manifest the presence of design. And if that's the case, then a designer must exist. We have one more point to make on this argument as well. And that is that the designer must be sufficient to account for the design. Not just any designer will do. Remember what Paul said in his passage here in Romans 1? God's invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. So we can infer certain things about anyone who could have designed something like what we're living in the midst of here. For one thing, there must have been vast intellect just to watch that system at work there and to think of imagining that at a time when it didn't exist and then somehow causing it to come into existence. The more we study this, the more bizarre and wild it is. I mean, the complexity is just, it's mind-boggling, like Kenyon said. Clearly, anyone who came up with this must have had will and intent. You know, it's like, there has to have been a plan made here. Like we could line up, adenine, guamine, cytosine, thymine, and then if we arrange them in different orders, then we could get it to come out. And then we'll come up with another thing called messenger RNA. That would be good. We can carry it out. I mean, there had to have been a planning, thinking process that went into this. I believe that, and that is will. That's intent. That's purposeful thinking. It's not just thinking. It's also willing. Forethought. To plan here about what you're going to do out there is forethought. These are all aspects that have to do with what we could call personal beings. This is not a force. You know, a lot of visions that people have, versions that people have of God, are impersonal. where God is just kind of like the life force in all things, kind of like magnetism or something like that. You know, may the force be with you. You know, that kind of thing. Well, the problem is, see, an impersonal force like that won't explain what we see when we behold creation. It's not enough. You would have to be thinking and planning and forming a purpose and then doing according to your purpose. In other words, you would have to be a thinking, personal being in order to create something like that. Of course, we could also probably infer great power to be able to make this kind of thing happen. And of course, we're only looking at one example here. I think there we could go into multiple other areas. Really, the entire universe ultimately springing into existence out of nothing is something that, according to the Bible, God did. That he prepared the worlds out of that which was not seen, out of nothing. Ex nihilo, out of nothing. And probably by implication, God must have been there before all these other things were there. And probably he must have been there forever. Or else we would be faced the same problem of who made God then. In all likelihood, we're looking at a being here who is infinite, eternal, and personal. An infinite personal creator. That's what we mean when we say his divine attributes, his eternal power and divine nature. You know, here's something kind of interesting. Now, this might not interest some of you if you don't like abstract things, but you can tune out if you want. I kind of think it's cool. So here we are presented with the need for an infinite personal God. Now, the gods that the Greeks worshipped, Hermes, Zeus, these people that they were talking about in this story, they were personal gods, but they were not infinite. They could be tricked, they made mistakes, they believed lies at some points. There's a story, famous story about Hercules tricking Zeus when he brought two sacks and said, which one do you want? And Zeus is like, that one. And it was just the hide and the fat of the animal, not the good meat parts. And so because of that, Zeus was stuck getting that on the sacrifices. You know, he gets the skin and the bones, we get the meat. And Zeus was, you know, pissed, angry about that. He goofed up. He messed up. That kind of stuff happened all the time. They were just really overgrown people. They were finite but personal. Now, on the other hand, you'll see a lot of religious conception in the world then and still today that is kind of pantheistic, where God is infinite, but he's not personal. He's more like the force, that sort of thing, the essence of the universe or something, but not a being that you would talk to, that would make decisions, that would have a will. Only really one place do we find the conception fully of an infinite personal God, and that is in this one ancient book called the Bible. Monotheism, that's the only place it comes from. All the religious thinking today that believes in infinite personal God all go back to the Bible for their source. That's where it came from. That'll really make you look at your Bible a little different the next time you pick it up. If you stop and think about that for a while, wonder how come no one else came up with this. Well, anyway, this is probably, it's along these lines. Now, they didn't know as much as we do about molecular biology, but they knew plenty to be able to see this is not an accident, okay, what happened here. And as a matter of fact, the more we've learned about it, the less we seem to realize the obvious. And so he argues God's there, and he's infinite and personal. You can tell that from his creation. And he says he provides you with plenty of food, and he fills your hearts with joy. And this is probably starting to refer to something about their inner feeling states and something like this. It's a good chance, knowing Paul, that what this is alluding to is that he went on to talk to them about when they look within themselves, that there are things within us that show us that God must be real. This is called internal general
revelation. A different argument. This is also found in Romans 1 in that same passage. He says in that one, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. Well, I wish we could just really unfold this. This is the argument from personality, from personhood, from mind, from consciousness. The fact is that when I look into myself, I see a being that tells me I'm on a vastly different level than a mere physical object. That there is something there that is, there's another dimension, the personal, the spiritual, the soul. The soul of humans is there and you can sense it. Think about why is it that people feel this need for significance? You know, there's no evidence that other animals have that. Even when our needs for food and sex and housing and everything are fully met, people will actually kill themselves deliberately because they just feel lost and insignificant and point that their life is pointless. This is a very powerful thing within humans that seems to be totally unique. What about freedom? Don't you sense, like I do, that we're making decisions? I believe that I'm making decisions that are free. I don't think, I don't always get to decide what I want, but I mean, a lot of the time I think I'm deciding things, and I think nobody's making me decide it. I just decide. How could that be in a materialistic world? You know, think about pouring vinegar on soda, and it fizzes up. Okay, and we could do that. If we put the same amount of soda and vinegar together, we can predict down to the smallest fraction how much CO2 is going to be released in the gases and what's left behind. And it will happen exactly like that every time we do that same reaction. And there won't be the slightest variation. That's because it's just matter reacting under physical law. And so there is no freedom of choice. The soda doesn't decide, well, I think I'll fizz right now. There's no decisions being made there whatsoever. There is no freedom. It's just a mechanical machine, a mechanical model of matter, energy, and physical law. Now, under the thesis that God's not there, that he's not real, everything is matter reacting with energy and physical law. How could anything then ever constitute a free choice? Your brain mechanism would just be chemistry reacting. And your belief that you're able to make a decision is actually completely illusory. Everything you're doing, you're completely determined to do. The chemical reaction's more complicated than vinegar and soda, but it's still just a chemical reaction. Moral emotions, the fact that people the world over and throughout history, they may not agree on what is moral and what is not moral, but they all seem to feel like we are moral beings. That there's such a thing as right and wrong. You know, I've been debating with people recently on this on the internet. I put the case to a guy who was, I said, you know, well, a lion will kill another lion if he comes into his territory. I said, so is that morally evil? And of course, come on, it's just a lion. I mean, that's what they do. Well, so then what's wrong with a human killing another human? You know, things just kind of seize up. The machinery seizes up when you realize your presuppositions don't match reality. And that's what happens when we try to deny things that we know perfectly well are true for the simple reason that we don't want to face the implications that we've been put here by an infinite personal creator. And we don't want to think about that. Our creativity, isn't that remarkable? A human goes out and looks at a scene. He comes home and begins to draw. And the next thing you know, he's got something that looks similar to what he just saw. Or he could sit there and draw and paint a scene that doesn't even exist, but it looks, it's made up of real components and looks as though it could exist. He just created it out of nothing, out of imagination. How come we're the only ones that ever do that?
How come there aren't any other creatures that do anything like that? We are not just with larger brains. It's not just a qualitative or quantitative difference. It's a qualitative difference. We're in a different category altogether than any other creature on earth. That should be obvious. Every time we think that love is something that's significant, a belief that probably most of us have here, a sense that we have this very strong, that it's actually significant when we love. If we were under a naturalistic model, love would be nothing but a chemical reaction in our brain, something completely without significance. Those are all things that tell us, and there's quite a few others as well, that tell us we are indeed personal, spiritual beings. And that points directly and immediately to a personal, spiritual creator. You know, evolution. Again, people say, well, you know, evolution is what I believe in. That has nothing to do with this. Evolution has to do with matter. It has to do with biological entities, genes, mutations, organisms. How do we cross over from the material to the immaterial, from the natural to the supernatural, to a soul, a spirit that would even survive the death of your body? No, Darwinism will not account for that. It couldn't possibly account for that. Only thing that would account for that is that if there's a soul in people, that must have been put in there by someone of the same or greater order, someone who's also a personal being. It suggests strongly that God's a personal being. Yes, it does. Now, natural selection would not explain any of this. And so we have Paul's argument for internal, general revelation. So here in talking to these people who have no respect for the Bible, don't even know what it is, he comes at them with what they do know, which is nature, which is themselves. And using as a point of contact general revelation, he's gonna guide them down toward special revelation. He says, even with these words, they had difficulty keeping the crowd from sacrificing to them. Well, it says some Jews came from Antioch, that earlier city, and Iconium, and they won the crowd over, dragged Paul out of the city, and stoned him to death. They believed. They left him for dead. And so this is not our kind of getting a stoning. This is the ancient type with like stones that break your skull, and people heave these big stones until you're dead. So he was a mess. I mean, he was just torn up and lying in a bloody mass there. They all go walking in. That'll teach you. And then, you know, we read, after the disciples had gathered, everyone standing around him saying, oh man, they killed our dude. All of a sudden he got up just like the Terminator, you know. Gets up with them and goes back into the same city where they just stoned him from. But he did leave the next day. Barnabas, they left, this is in Lystra, so they left back to Derbe. Well, they preached the good news more in that city. They won a large number of disciples. Then they returned to Lystra, to Iconium, to Antioch, strengthening the disciples and encouraging them to remain true to the faith. So they're back going back through the same cities that they'd been in earlier, saying we must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God. Well, how encouraging is that? So we have to go through many tribulations to enter the kingdom of God. Doesn't sound that encouraging. Well, I guess in a way it is, you know, because to be forewarned is to be forearmed. You know, it's like I think we need to know that the Christian life includes a lot of suffering. And that's what they're warning these guys. Obviously, they've been suffering the whole time, being chased from city to city and finally caught up with and stoned and death and so forth. And they're like, okay, people can get pretty raw about this whole thing, and it's just all kinds of suffering that we have to live through in a fallen world. So get ready for it. And finally, then we read Paul and Barnabas appointed elders for them in each church.
and with prayer and fasting committed them to the Lord in whom they had put their trust. That verse is important because of the fact that it's plural elders for them in each church, singular. The word church is just a gathering, an assembly. And so even in these fairly small towns where these groups were probably pretty small, way smaller than what we see here tonight, maybe the biggest ones with a couple hundred, but and yet in each one, multiple elders, what it shows is a plurality of elders was a purposeful policy that they pursued. Because in the biblical way they ran things, you never put one like dictator, you know, person in charge. Instead, you get a group of people and have team leadership for the sake of accountability to each other. And also, it makes it less likely that the group's going to be deceived and carried away. Unfortunately, the so-called Christian church, the institutional church, went away from this within 100 and so years. You had this whole practice was just completely disappeared. And you had single bishops that ran entire dioceses. Plurality of leadership. Right there, Acts 14:23. Well, after going through Pisidia, they came to Pamphylia. When they had reached word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. And they got on a ship, sailed back to Antioch, where they had been originally committed to the grace of God for the work they had now completed, and the first journey was over. On arriving there, they gathered the church together and reported all that God had done through them, how he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles, and he stayed there a long time with the disciples. And so came out pretty good, and all up and down that whole stretch, we find that people had come to the same conclusion that God seems like he's real, and that in fact he's more real than these little gods we've made up that are like pseudo gods, and that what we need is the living God, the creator of all things. And so they put their faith in God. Faith is what God wants from us. He wants us to trust him, to come to him in person, to let him forgive us for the things that we've done that are wrong. This is why Jesus came. And to invite him to come into our lives so we can start having a personal relationship with him. That's what faith in God is all about. And there you have the first journey. If you want to do some reading on the subjects we were talking about tonight, the argument from design, Behe and Dembski, Science and the Evidence for Design in the Universe. Dembski's No Free Lunch. Michael Denton, a guy who's not even a believer. He doesn't believe in God, but he still thinks that evolution has not shown how things can work here, a theory in crisis. Jonathan Wells, Icons of Evolution, Science or Myth. And Lee Strobel, The Case for the Creator, which I'm sure we have that one out here in the bookstore. Are all good reading you can do if you want to go way more in depth than we have here tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.